climate change adaptation needs to be very specific to the area, to the issue that they have. Federalism provides such opportunity to have local government create their own solution.
There are different answers and different ways to go. And there we need a competition about good ideas.
One thing that's new is the undeniable impacts of climate change. It's a reality check, and it's scary.
This is Forum Fedcast, Episode 9, Federalism and Climate Change. Part 1, Getting Hot in Here. In March 2023, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC, released its latest assessment of international efforts to mitigate global warming. The synthesis report from the UN body responsible for evaluating climate change science is a sobering read for those who hoped that the heating of the planet could be limited to a level which would avoid the most damaging impacts on people and the environment. Under current plans and actions, average global temperature is almost certain to increase by more than 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, and climate change mitigation efforts will have to expand significantly in the 2030s in order to keep temperatures from increasing by more than 2 degrees.
When the first legally binding climate treaty, the Kyoto Protocol, entered into force in 2005, the agreement was widely criticized for not compelling countries to act on climate change and for overlooking the role of local and subnational governments. 10 years on, the 2015 Paris Agreement aimed to address some of the shortcomings of Kyoto, and it remains the centerpiece of the international community's efforts to combat climate change. With the aim of limiting global warming to well below 2 degrees Celsius, the Paris Treaty commits the 196 country signatories to progressively reducing their greenhouse gas emissions and building resilience to the effects of rising temperatures. Through the Binding Nationally Determined Contributions, or NDCs, countries set out their plans for reducing their impact on the climate and environment.
The Paris Agreement is a clear sign that preventing climate catastrophe is at the top of the international political agenda. But, as the IPCC report highlights, there is little time left to act, and achieving concerted global action will not be simple. Climate action does not impact all countries equally, and there are varying levels of capacity to implement adaptation and mitigation strategies between the global north and global south in particular. Climate change is also a politically contested issue. There are tensions between economic growth and the reduction of carbon emissions, especially in countries which extract fossil fuels. At a policy level, there are significant concerns over how progress towards carbon neutrality can be made in challenging economic conditions, with energy and food crises driving inflation to highs not seen for decades.
While the Paris Agreement is a global plan signed up to by national governments, it is clear that a crucial role will be played by subnational and local governments in the fight against climate change. To achieve the reductions in carbon emissions required to meet the objectives established by the agreement, all levels of government, as well as civil society, academic and business communities must take action and affect change.
On the surface, responding to climate change in federal countries potentially presents a challenge. Climate action is an effort which cuts across many different policy areas, from the economy to health, disaster management, and more. And, as with the signatories to the Paris Agreement, governments within federal countries are not all equal. They may have differing strategies, capacities, and political will to tackle the issue.
So, what are the key governance dynamics at play in federal countries' efforts to tackle climate change? What are the opportunities and challenges of climate governance within a federal or multi-level governance structure? As we press forward with increasingly ambitious climate change mitigation and adaptation measures, what have we learned about federal countries' efforts to reach their Paris Agreement objectives? And can we identify any good practices in federal climate governance that we can take into the future? This episode of Forum Fedcast is just warming up. So join us as we discuss the scorching hot issue of federalism and climate change.
Countries all around the world are grappling with the big picture challenge of climate change, whether they're federal or unitary. So, to kick us off, what is it that distinguishes federal systems when it comes to climate policy?
Let's go back to the fundamentals. When we think of what differentiates a federal system from a unitary one, there's two key features here that are profoundly relevant.
Alan Fenner is Professor of Politics at Curtin University in Western Australia.
One is that federalism creates a system with two distinct orders of government, each equipped in most federal systems with substantial range of powers and policy competence. Right? And the second is, on that constituent unit level, we have multiple governments across the country. So there's vertically, there's the difference between two orders of government, and horizontally, there's a range of different governments spanning the territory. So this immediately creates a variety of potentials and risks for public policy in general. And this has long been discussed in the federalism literature, whether federalism has certain advantages because of that multiplicity of governments. Should just add here that we're talking generally about climate change policy, but it's very useful to think of it in terms of its two very different aspects. One is mitigation, the effort to reduce the production of greenhouse gases, and the other is adaptation to the inevitable changes that are occurring. And these have quite different implications in terms of federalism as well, because the incentives are very different in the two.
Over the past several years, the Forum's research project on federalism and climate change has been exploring the dynamics of multi-level governance systems and climate change policy development and implementation. The book covering the findings includes 14 case studies of climate governance in federal countries around the world. As Professor Fenna, one of the volume's editors, explains, the research suggests federal models can provide systemic opportunities for progressive action on climate change.
In the book, what we've done is distill those down to three particular opportunities or benefits or ways in which federalism may facilitate climate governance. So one of those is that because of having a range of governments with important policy roles across the country, policy can be tailored or customized to local circumstances much better and respond to local preferences much better than a unitary state would. So that's one possible benefit of a federal system as far as climate governance is concerned. The second is that if the central government fails to act, then there is a fail-safe mechanism. There is the ability for the constituent units to step up and take action that the central government is not taking. Sometimes this is called compensatory federalism, that the one order of government can compensate for failures at the other level. And the third that's often been talked about in the federalism literature is because you have a multiplicity of governments across the country, there's much greater scope for policy experimentation. So some particularly adventurous jurisdiction might try something new, demonstrate it works, and others can learn from the example. Or they might try something new, demonstrate it's a disaster, and other jurisdictions know to avoid it.
So the research shows that the features of federal systems create opportunities for climate governance. But do they provide real advantages for climate policy in diverse federations?
I think they do. And I think there's a lot of different dynamics that can emerge because of the diversity of federal systems.
Catherine Harrison is Professor of Political Science at the University of British Columbia. She is the author of the Canada Case Study in the Forum book and of the Forum's Climate Governance Policy paper, The Challenge of Federalism for Canadian Climate Policy.
Some of them are positive, where you can see subnational leadership on climate change. If there are green leaders at the state or provincial level, that can create a dynamic where those states or provinces are innovative, they devise new policies, or even if the policies aren't novel, they may simply be willing to act unilaterally. And that can provide reassurance to other provinces or states that, you know, hey, our industries aren't going to suffer, we can all do this. So you can have an innovation and diffusion dynamic that is launched by those green leaders.
Tackling climate change requires action at all levels, at the international, national, regional, and local. But the impacts of climate change often vary from country to country and even region to region. Some argue that federalism can provide space for local leadership to provide more tailored policies which better meet the needs of particular areas.
I think it has an impact. It's very important that we try to improve measurements and actions against climate change on all levels, on international level, of course, on the national level, but on the regional, local level as well.
Dr. Carsten Seeling is a former member of the National Parliament of Germany, the Bundestag, and served as the mayor of the city of Bremen from 2015 to 2019. From 2019, he was a member of the Bremen Regional Parliament's Enquete Commission, Climate Protection Strategy for the State of Bremen, which aimed to find ways of limiting the impact of climate change and to protect the natural environment in the city-state.
federal nations have the advantage that on the federal level, you can develop measures and actions and proposals, and you can realize them because you have the resources to do it. And of course, it's necessary to have the financial opportunities. And this you have in a federal system, very much on this federal level, regional level. And there you can act and solve the problems much more precisely because you see the consequences of climate change locally, and you also see what to do precisely, and you can do it with the people, and that's very important as well, and with the companies and the economic actors as well.
The ability that federalism provides to accommodate more customized policies resonates in different parts of the world where people face different climate challenges. It also allows the space for more diverse stakeholders to become involved in shaping responses to climate change at local levels.
I think federalism provides more opportunities for many stakeholders to play a role and to create their own specific solution. Because again, climate change impact is very specific to the context, right?
Dr. Warathida Chayappa is a lecturer and assistant director at the School of Public Policy at Chiang Mai University in Thailand. Over the past year, Dr. Chayappa has been leading a comparative forum research study examining the impact of governance models on climate change policy in two countries in Southeast Asia, Federal Malaysia and Unitary Thailand.
This area may have flood. This area may experience drought, something like that. Climate change adaptation needs to be very specific to the area, to the issue that they have. And multi-level governance or the federalism have provided such opportunity to have local government create their own solution, involved in the policy making process for themselves, and citizens in their local area can be included easily, right? That's opportunity that I see from being federal state more than unitarian state.
As we know, the impacts of climate change vary in scale and severity from country to country, depending on their geographical, climatic, and economic conditions and vulnerability. For example, the effects on Canada are very different to those experienced by people on the Solomon Islands. Similarly, as Alan explains, climate policy in federations is highly context-dependent and affected by many different factors.
And one thing the book really taught us is that the dynamics of federalism and climate change are highly contingent on the specifics of each country. How federalism works and which level of government is better placed to take action is contingent on the political economy of the country in question. It's like Tolstoy says, each unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. Each federal system is wrestling with its own dynamics, and what it gets is a result of its own circumstances and dynamics. It's not that the Swiss have showed us how to do it, or the Germans have showed us how to do it, that sort of thing. That's not the case. Each one of them does what the nature of its political economy and its federal system lead it to do.
But what about the specifics? For Catherine, there are a number of significant factors which contribute to shaping climate policy and governance in federal systems.
Not all federations are the same, and I think when we think about climate change, there are a few specific areas of difference and can be really important. I mean, one obvious thing is how centralized or decentralized the federation is when it comes to relevant areas of authority, governing production of fossil fuels, regulating sources of greenhouse gas emissions, whether it's motor vehicles, electricity generators, homes, city design, and so on. So that's important. Whether the economy is regionally varied. So if all of the states or provinces had kind of similar challenges in addressing climate change, I think it probably wouldn't matter as much. But if you have a situation where the most fossil fuel intensive industries, including heavy industries that burn fossil fuels, production of fossil fuels, are regionally concentrated, in that situation, if you also have a decentralized federation where the provinces or states that are at risk of bearing the greatest costs in addressing climate change are responsible for key decisions about production of fossil fuels, regulation of greenhouse gas intensive industries, then it becomes a lot more difficult to mitigate climate change and reduce that country's emissions and production of fossil fuels that are primarily what's causing this problem.
So the specific context and internal dynamics of a federation affect the way climate policy is developed and actioned. And as per the 2015 Paris Agreement, national efforts are situated within broader international commitments.
Let me take you to the very big picture first, like at a global level. So, you know, every country who is the parties of UNFCCC, right, has to submit their commitment, like the nationally determined contributions, NDCs, to the UNFCCC, saying that, oh, my country will reduce greenhouse gas, this greenhouse gas emission, this percentage. So that is the commitment of every country. Then the question is, well, when the national government declares such or submits such pledge to the UNFCCC, they go back to their home country and they try to implement, right, the climate agreement that they signed to the UNFCCC.
However, as Warathita notes, federal and unitary countries approach meeting their commitments in different ways.
The problem is that if there are unitary states, they can just simply order, top-down order, to the local administration office or ministry, something like that, to do the national climate policy, right, to follow the goal and the achievement. But imagine if you are a federal state, the federal government needs to convince the state governments to follow their policy. And it's not always the direction that state government will follow the policy from the federal government, right? So that's the case. So we have seen that sometimes state government do not follow the federal government's policy.
Disagreements between different orders of government on what climate policy should be and how it should be implemented highlights the importance of party politics. In federations, party politics may present a challenge to maintaining a coherent approach to climate governance across the country.
This also raises the question of the challenges to progressive climate policy in federations. As Alan explains, in certain contexts, the potential benefits provided by federal structures may be blocked in various ways.
On the other side of the coin, there are possible risks that will negate these benefits. So you might get competition between the constituent units for investment that drives down in areas like the environment. You might get coordination problems, that one order of government is doing one thing, the other order is doing another, and they're not meshing, and to some extent undermining each other. Or similarly across the country, one jurisdiction is doing one thing, another jurisdiction is doing something else. They would work much better if they were better coordinated. Or one of them is failing to act, and you need some top-down coordination to force a jurisdiction to act. So there are various ways in which federalism may not deliver those benefits as far as climate change is concerned.
While on one side of the coin, federalism can provide space for green leaders, on the other side, it may also inadvertently provide a platform for the obstruction of green policies nationally, particularly in a context where consensus is part of the federal culture.
If there is an expectation of federal-provincial consensus in a federation that puts a lot of emphasis on collaboration and cooperation, we can see obstruction. There, the issue is not the green leaders, it's the laggards, the brown laggards that are resisting moving forward that may be in a position to obstruct action on climate change. And honestly, in that sort of innovation and diffusion dynamic, what I haven't seen is the laggards being convinced. There can be truncated diffusion of new policies among the really green and not so green subnational governments. But do the states or provinces whose economies rely heavily on fossil fuel production, are they won over by their neighbors' novel policies? Not so much. It can go in a lot of different directions.
Political leadership and the partisan political divide over climate action, particularly how much it is prioritized in policymaking, is a key factor which shapes climate governance in unitary and federal states. In federations, the partisan political divide, the political economy, and the federal dynamics of the country in question all interact in ways which can support or inhibit progressive policy.
I think that what I've described in Australia is typical of a number of countries where climate change politics, the partisan divide is very clear, that on the conservative side of politics, there's a great resistance to either to even acceptance of the problem, but certainly to taking radical action to address it. Whereas the tendency on the left, among left parties, is to be more willing to take climate change action, more concerned about climate change problem. And so that's played out in Brazil, it's played out in the United States, it's played out in Canada, it's played out in Australia. So that's, I would say, is the main partisan dynamic around it. Then that overlays what the particular political economy is in any country. So if you're a party in a highly carbon-dependent jurisdiction, then that's going to strongly influence the politics as well. So in Australia, the fact is the Australian economy has been highly tied to carbon emission technologies. So Australia is a massive exporter of coal and minerals. It generates almost all its electricity from burning coal. It has huge coal reserves, you know, up to 1,000 years supply. So it's quite understandable from a politically conservative point of view, the idea of turning your back on all this wealth generating resource seems crazy. And it particularly seems crazy when you know that a country like Australia makes negligible contribution to the global total greenhouse gas emissions anyway. So you can see the close relationship between the partisan dynamics and the actual political economy of the country in question.
Policy coherence can be especially difficult to achieve where there are different political parties at different levels with different priorities.
Okay, let's talk a little bit on the limitation. It's about politics. So if the state government happen to be in the same political parties with the national government, that is fine. The policy direction will be the same, right? But if something happened, like with the political parties of the government, local government and state government are different from the national government, then we have trouble. That's the challenge that I found from having federalism.
In fossil fuel intensive economies like Canada, these partisan challenges have been an important factor affecting climate change policymaking.
The political party system in Canada is not entirely independent of climate change or the federal system. So in Canadian politics, I think especially because Canada has such a fossil fuel intensive economy, the Conservative Party and its provincial equivalents, which may have different names, is the strongest defender of the existing business community. And that tends to mean in many regions, the fossil fuel industry and fossil fuel intensive industries. And then you layer on top of that a federal system where 80% of Canada's oil production comes from Alberta and another 10% from Saskatchewan. So like these two provinces are producing most of the oil. They have conservative governments. And it is the conservative politicians in those provinces that are fighting a liberal federal government.
The challenges of party politics can exacerbate the more practical issues involved in dealing with climate change within a federal system. Even in federations with a more cooperative federal culture, such as Germany, governments face coordination issues. As Carsten explains, the importance of a coordinated response becomes very clear during climate change-driven emergencies.
Of course, there are different problems if you have a federal structure and if you have the different levels of governments. The problems occur if the cooperation doesn't work precisely. And especially in situations, in emergency cases, it can be difficult. In Germany, we had this in the last year as we had the flood problem after a lot of rain in the Ahr Valley, the River Ahr, and there the cooperation between the different areas, between the police and the rescue services and all these very important institutions didn't work that precisely because informations on the national level wasn't in the region as fast as it had to be. And on the other hand, the regional informations about the situation there didn't reach other institutions that fast. So that shows if you have a federal system, it has to be worked precisely. But I think even if you have a very centralized governance structure, that can occur these kind of problems.
In some federations, it's not just the differences between federal and subnational governments which shapes climate governance. In some cases, subnational units have very different perspectives and positions on climate change. As Catherine explains, Canada provides an interesting example of what can happen when two provinces are going in different directions.
Let's get more concrete and talk about two Canadian provinces. The one I live in is British Columbia. It's on the West Coast. Right next door is Alberta. British Columbia has almost 100% clean electricity generation because we happen to have a lot of hydroelectric potential and fairly modest by Canadian standards per capita emissions, you know, between 10 and 20 tons per person. I can't remember the exact number. I think about 15. Alberta is the center of Canada's oil and gas production and also historically has gotten its electricity from fossil fuel, from burning coal, increasingly gas. And Alberta's per capita emissions are about 65 tons per person per year, which would be like way higher than any country in the world. Perhaps not surprisingly, they have taken quite different positions historically on climate policy. British Columbia had adopted Canada's first revenue neutral carbon tax back in 2008, pushed for deeper reductions in emissions, committed to 100% clean electricity, which was pretty easily done because we're already at like 95%. And Alberta has been the resistance, the center of the resistance. The provincial government has fought climate initiatives, has funded something called the War Room, which exists to defend the Canadian oil and gas industry's reputation, sometimes, honestly, with some quite misleading statements. So these are two provinces that have had very different positions on climate policy. They have had spats between them, where Alberta wanted strongly supported building a pipeline across British Columbia so that Alberta's oil exports could reach new markets, especially in Asia. But Alberta's landlocked, and British Columbia opposed that pipeline. And at one point, they were suing each other. The premier of Alberta wanted Alberta liquor stores no longer to carry wine made in British Columbia. I mean, some of it was just ridiculous. And I think the natural assumption is, wouldn't it be great if they could get along?
The conflictual dynamic seen in the Canadian case challenged Canada's ability to tackle climate change because, as Carson explains, there is a need for national and subnational coordination to implement effective climate policy. Cooperation and coordination between different levels of government, and also between governments at the same level, is crucial.
In Germany, the federal level is, compared to a lot of other countries and federations, quite strong. There are measures to react in different areas, not just the main issues like security or educational policy, but on economic development as well. For example, you have the opportunity to decide regional development issues, city development, and different things, planning of infrastructure and things like this. And so these are important measures to use for actions against climate change. And you can't do it without support from the national level that you need. If there will be a policy which is not supporting it, then it's quite difficult. But on the other hand, if the national government tries to roll out policy in this manner and on the regional level in the Länder in Germany, it will not be supported, then there's a problem as well.
While the specific dynamics of federalism and climate policy are complex, in terms of making progress, so far the actions that have been taken can be thought of as either carrot or stick approaches. In other words, incentives or disincentives for governments at different levels to take positive or negative action on climate-related issues. In some cases, such as in Malaysia, the central government has focused on providing incentives to encourage subnational governments to be proactive.
Let's take Malaysia as our case study to talk about. So Malaysia, right? The Malaysian government set up very interesting discourse that convinced all state governments to follow that direction. They kind of established the discourse that climate change is not a threat or is not a burden. Especially climate change mitigation. People feel so concerned that if we mitigate the climate change or reduce greenhouse gas emission, it will increase the cost, right, for the business, for example. But Malaysian government successfully established the discourse that actually climate change mitigation can bring the business opportunity, can generate income, can expand the green growth. For example, the green technology, green service, you know. So that is kind of the discourse that Malaysian government successfully established. And when the state government see the same discourse, they see the opportunity for themselves. They see the opportunity to generate income, to create jobs, to be green, to create green growth in their own territory. So they follow the direction of national climate policy.
In federal systems, creating an environment where action on climate change can be taken either cooperatively or competitively by governments can help to incentivize progressive policy.
You can develop different ways of solving problems. We all don't know what has to go on precisely in future. And very often, in a very many cases, for example, to organize and reorganize the traffic sector and the public transport and the commuting to work and all these things, there have to be different solutions and a lot of solutions. So it's an opportunity and a chance to develop different, maybe a competitive situation, competitive in a positive manner, where good examples will be produced and will be developed, and we all together can learn from this. So it's a situation where you have to have framework where cooperation and competition has to be worked out on both sides.
I think in general, federalism is highly conducive to adaptation, because adaptation means making changes that are relevant to the specific circumstances of a specific area, then the fact that federalism allows great policy scope to the constituent units, you've got a perfect marriage of scale there. I'll also add to that that because the benefits of adaptation are retained locally, you're not making a sacrifice for the world, you're simply looking after yourself, then the adverse effects of federalism are not evident with adaptation. You're not going to be held back by thinking, well, why should I make a sacrifice when others aren't? Because any adaptation measures you put in place are exclusively for your own benefit. So not only is the scale right, but the incentives are right for federalism. So federalism and adaptation are a marriage made in heaven. Not so for mitigation.
On the other hand, if providing incentives doesn't work, there are stick approaches to climate policy. In the case of Canada, the stick was the imposition of national environmental standards. In Catherine's view, this was the only way for positive progress to be made in the Canadian context.
The solution was the federal government weighed in and adopted consistent national environmental policies that apply to both provinces. Because honestly, Alberta has no reason to get along with British Columbia. So I think in some cases we overestimate the importance of cooperation, when cooperation often means compromise between a jurisdiction that relies on fossil fuels. And fossil fuels are what is causing climate change, and a jurisdiction that doesn't rely on them. Maybe we need something else, which is a national government to step in and impose consistent policies that apply to both. And those premiers can continue to fight if they want. I don't care.
So, what can we learn from the way federations have approached climate change so far? In terms of making progress on global warming, which is more effective, the carrot or the stick?
I mean, one thing that does come through is that in those frequent situations where you have jurisdictions at the constituent unit level that are shirking, that putting in place a floor, but then having incentives for some jurisdictions to go beyond that in terms of their action is the ideal role for central government in many ways. You want to have a framework at the national level, let's call it the central government level, a framework at the central government level that rules out or that puts a limit on emissions, but at the same time encourages more adventurous jurisdictions to take more ambitious action.
I think in 2019, it was absolutely fundamental that the government of Canada said, we're doing this and we'll defend it in court. And they won. Because what we were seeing is even the provinces who were acting on climate change at the subnational level, the emissions growth from the oil industry has swamped all of those gains. Canada's emissions went up from 1990 to 2005, even as we, you know, embraced all of these bold targets to reduce our emissions. And then they pretty much stabilized since then. Little dips, depending what's happening to the economy. But we have yet to reduce our emissions. We have reduced them in certain sectors, but what's happened is growing emissions from the oil industry have swamped that. So it was absolutely critical that there be a national government that says, no, we are going to reduce our emissions, and that will entail reductions from many sectors, including the oil and gas industry.
The other thing that comes through, and this has been a weakness in the Australian case, because, you know, when the two orders of government are at loggerheads over a policy, as they have been over climate change, and even if the states have stepped up in Australia, there still remain coordination problems. And so the ideal framework is one where perhaps whatever level of government is taking leadership, at the same time, there are very good mechanisms of coordination and collaboration between the two level governments. And that does come through quite strongly. The Australian states have still achieved a lot without an optimal degree of coordination, but it would be better, they would achieve more, and Australia would achieve more with more effective coordination of policy. For partisan political reasons, that's often not easy to achieve, but that's the ideal outcome. High levels of coordination, a performance floor imposed by a central government, are two kind of best practice examples, I think, that would stand out.
Alongside minimum national standards and high levels of coordination, Karsten believes that a policy environment which encourages regulated competition in the area of climate governance can provide good results. But what is regulated competition?
There can be competition about subsidies and about support, supporting financial aid and so on, of course. But the competition I meant was more a competition about good ideas. Good ideas and competition to find ways out of the climate problem. Because there are different answers and different ways to go. And there we need a lot of proposals. We can't say there is just one technological or one way of economic development which solves the problem. So that's, in my opinion, the chance of competition. So it has to be, of course, a regulated competition, because it's not helpful if the competition leads to a situation where the one subnational area does something and the other does nothing. That's not the solution. We have to come to a situation where, yeah, everybody is struggling for the best way and for the best idea.
Let's return to the three key opportunities federalism provides for climate policy we heard about at the beginning of the episode. Number one, local tailoring of climate policy. Number two, compensatory federalism. And number three, policy experimentation and learning. What has the research shown about these dynamics?
It is pretty clear that as far as mitigation is concerned, the first and third provide very little benefit for climate change. Local tailoring, as far as mitigation, just means that Alberta can do what it wants and Quebec does what it wants, and the end result is more greenhouse gas emissions. So the compensatory one, we certainly see lots of evidence of. The third one is the most intriguing in a way, which is often held up as one of the most exciting benefits of federalism, which is that ability for policy experimentation and learning. There's very little evidence in these studies of that occurring, primarily because the problem has not been one of finding new ways to solve the issue. It's the problem has been actually implementing, making the political decision to implement. The demonstration effect of successful examples has not been significant. It's really only the second possibility, that of compensatory action, that we see clear evidence of federalism providing some benefit in climate change policy.
In the Canadian case, Catherine believes that the experimentation and compensatory opportunities that federalism may provide must be backed up by consistent regulation.
I mean, I think policy differentiation is an interesting issue because it is celebrated as one of the advantages of federalism. I think when it comes to climate change, we often overstate how important that is. There are certain areas where it's important, you know, urban design, how we design our cities, how we zone multi-unit versus large lot family homes has a big impact on how much people have to drive around, whether they invest in transit, those sorts of things. And I think necessarily much of that is going to be decentralized, whether it's within a unitary system with cities or in a federal system. But a lot of what needs to be done in addressing climate change is regulation of industry. The people who are producing the goods that are used in those homes, the industrial sources, consumption of fossil fuels. And then it can be really challenging if you have different standards in different provinces, because those industries will argue that they face a competitive disadvantage. So that's one of the reasons why one would want to see consistent national standards for sectors that could produce in different countries, could produce their goods in different countries.
Federalism hasn't provided the degree of challenge to climate change policy as it might have. There hasn't been, say, the race to the bottom in standards that some people feared would occur. Jurisdictions have been quite willing in Australia to make expensive commitments to climate change, regardless of the fact that the benefits are shared by everybody. The collective action problem hasn't been as acute as logic would lead us to expect.
The opportunities that federal systems may provide for innovative, tailored climate policy are only going to become more relevant as the impacts of climate change threaten more lives and livelihoods. And this is not just a future problem. Many federal states are currently experiencing the effects of a warming planet. As Catherine explains, the frequency and scale of climate-related emergencies are increasing.
I think one thing that's new is the undeniable impacts of climate change. And it's a reality check, and it's scary, that's being injected into the Canadian Federation. So I live in British Columbia. 2021 was quite extraordinary in British Columbia. There was a three-day period referred to as a heat dome in late June 2021, when it's not just that temperature records were broken in British Columbia, they were shattered by multiple degrees. Like, that doesn't happen. It was over 40 degrees for multiple days running, and in a place that usually has a pretty moderate climate and people don't have air conditioning. The town of Lytton, the temperature hit 49.6 degrees, and then the town burned to the ground the next day. Literally the next day, the whole town burned to the ground, and there were wildfires all over British Columbia. More than 600 people died, most of them in the middle of a wealthy urban area. And these were people, they tended to be older. They were living alone in apartment buildings in less wealthy neighborhoods. And so in a wealthy country like Canada, hundreds of my neighbors baked in their homes because of a heat wave that scientists say simply could not have happened without climate change.
In the second part of our series on federalism and climate change, we'll examine more closely how federations have approached climate policy, going deep on Canada, Australia, Malaysia, Germany, and more. And we'll explore other factors that could play a role in supporting progress in federations, including the actions of the private sector and of individuals. So for this and much more, make sure you tune in for the next episode coming to your podcast feeds very soon. That was Forum Fedcast. Huge thanks to our guests, Alan Fenner, Catherine Harrison, Warathida Chayapa, and Carsten Seely.
For more on the Forum's work on climate change and federalism, check out our website at forumfed.org. The Forum's book, Climate Governance and Federalism, A Form of Federation's Comparative Policy Analysis, will be published in May 2023. Professor Harrison's paper, The Challenge of Federalism for Canadian Climate Policy, will also be available this May. Stay tuned to the Forum's social media channels. You can find us on Twitter at ForumFed and as the Forum of Federations on Facebook, YouTube, and LinkedIn. Connect with us and say hi.
After a bit of a hiatus in 2022, Forum Fedcast is back. And as always, we want you to get in touch. Send your thoughts on federalism and climate change to podcast@forumfed.org. That's podcast@forumfed.org. Drop us a line and tell us what we missed, and let us know what subject you would like to be covered on future episodes. For previous episodes of the podcast, just search Forum Fedcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or Podbean. And if you enjoy the show, please subscribe and give us a 5-star review. This episode was written and hosted by
Jamie Thomas
and me, Liam Whittington. It was produced by Liam Whittington and Xenia Wasi. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you next time on Forum Fedcast.